Jaya Radha Madhava Punjabi Hari. Gopi Jana Varada Giri Varada Gopi Jana Varada Giri Varada Yashoda Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana Yashoda Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana Yamuna Tira Ranachari Yamuna Tira Ranachari Jaya Madhava Punjabi Hari Jaya Radha Madhava Transcendental Book Distribution Ki Jai. New Ramanriti Dharma Ki Jai. Gaura Premanand. All glorious to the assembled devotees. All glorious to Sri Sri Guru Angaranga. Jai Sri Prabhupada. Jana Timurandam Siyasam Jaya Shalakaya Chakshuram Itam Yena Tasmaya Sri Guru Namah Sri Chaitanya Manavisam Sakatam Yagutam I am Rupa Karam, I am the Vakra Sakatam Siyam Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Yuta Parakamalam Sri Guru Vaisnavam Siyam Sri Rupam Sakrajatam Sahagana Raghunatam Vitam Sam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savarutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Sri Vakram Krishna Param Sahagana Lavisa Sri Vishakam Vitam Sam Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya So today's verse is the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 17, Verse 19. Please repeat. Kechit vikalpa vasana Kechit vikalpa vasana Ahur atmanam atmanah Dairam anye pare karma Svabhavam apare prabhum Kechit vikalpa vasana Ahur atmanam atmana Devim anye pare karma Svabhavam apare prabhum Kechit vikalpa vasana
Some of them, Vikalpavasanaha, those who deny all kinds of duality, Ahu, declare, Atmanam, own self, Atmanaha, of the self, Devam, superhuman, Anye, others, Apare, someone else. Karma, activity. Svabhavam, material nature. Apare, many other. Prabhum, authority. Translation by Srila Prabhupada. Some of the philosophers who deny all sorts of duality declare that one's own self is responsible for his personal happiness and distress. Others say that superhuman powers are responsible, while yet others say that activity is responsible. And the gross materialists maintain that nature is the ultimate cause. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. As referred to above, philosophers like Jaimini and his followers establish that fruitive activity is the root cause of all distress and happiness, and that even if there is a superior authority, some superhuman powerful god or gods, he or they are also under the influence of fruitive activity, because they reward results according to one's action. They say that action is not independent, because action is performed by some performer. Therefore, the performer himself is the cause of his own happiness or distress. In the Bhagavad Gita 6.5 also, it is confirmed that by one's mind, freed from material affection, one can deliver himself from the sufferings of material pangs. So, one should not entangle oneself in matter by the mind's material affections. Thus, one's own mind is one's friend or enemy in one's material happiness and distress. Atheistic materialistic Shankyites conclude that material nature is the cause of all causes. According to them, combinations of material elements are the causes of material happiness and distress, and disintegration of matter is the cause of freedom from all material pangs. Gotama and Kanada find that atomic combination is the cause of everything. And impersonalists like Ashtavakra discover that the spiritual effulgence of Brahman is the cause of all causes. But in the Bhagavad Gita, the Lord himself declares that he is the source of impersonal Brahman, and therefore he, the personality of Godhead, is the ultimate cause of all causes. It's also confirmed in the Brahma Samhita that Lord Krishna is the ultimate cause of all causes. Kechit vikalpavasana ahur atmanam atmanaha devamanye pare karma svabhavam apare prabhum. Some of the philosophers who deny all sorts of duality declare that one's own self is responsible for his personal happiness and distress, Others say that superhuman powers are responsible, while yet others say that activity is responsible. And the gross materialists maintain that nature is the ultimate cause. So, in that purport, Srila Prabhupada mentions Bhagavad Gita, verse 6.5, which is, one must deliver himself with the help of his mind and not degrade himself. The mind is the friend of the conditioned soul and his enemy as well. So, the mind's material affections, on a very gross level, can be seen in terms of the things that we, when we take initiation, agree to cease doing. That's the four regulative principles: the illicit sex life, gambling, intoxication, and meat eating. But actually, every aspect of material life, in perhaps more subtle ways, is some form of involves some form of material affection. That, you know, we are attached to these bodies that we have, to the lives that we lead, even if we're leading a good life. So, in material existence, Prabhupada says in the purport to that Bhagavad Gita verse, one is subjected to the influence of the mind and the senses. So this reminds me of when I was working as a counselor in mental health and substance abuse, and the times where I had to conduct substance abuse groups for people who had problems with alcoholism or drug addiction. So that's a very gross form of attachment to material sense gratification. And in that treatment, if you're familiar with this kind of work, it's known that the 12-step programs, like Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous, are really the most successful types of treatment for people trying to get free from substance use. Now, Prabhupada used to say many times, because in the 1960s, drugs, of course, were a big problem, and particularly LSD was frequently mentioned, that the government would spend so much money on programs to help people get off drugs, but they were unsuccessful. But as soon as somebody walked in the doors of the Hare Krishna temple, then they very easily were able to give up these kind of drugs and alcohol. So that's because Prabhupada is giving something to replace the addiction to drugs. He's giving the Bhakti Yoga, which enables, in the holy name, which enables the person to put something else in their life in its place. So the 12-step programs are known to be successful. And in fact, in the groups that I used to run, part of the program was that outside of the treatment groups at the clinic, that the participants were obliged to go to AA or NA meetings in their own time during the week. So what is it about these programs that makes them at least somewhat successful? So if we look at the 12 steps, or some of them, we can see that actually they are, you can interpret them as being a kind of very simple bhakti yoga. So the first step is like surrender to the Supreme Lord. The first step says, we admitted we were powerless over our addiction, that our lives have become unmanageable. Then two is we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And three is we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. Right? So that, those first three really expresses a surrender of the person to Krishna, even though they don't know mostly that, that God is called Krishna. And then at the end, numbers 11 and 12, they say, we sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. So they're surrendering to God and they somehow want to know what God's will is for them so that they can lead their lives by carrying out God's will, which is kind of, you know, getting towards bhakti. And the last one says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we try to carry this message to addicts and to practice these principles in all our affairs. In other words, they're doing kind of AA or NA Sankirtan by spreading this process. So it's also constructed in such a way that although the people who came up with this program in the middle of the 20th century came from a Christian or Judeo-Christian background, they understood that alcoholics or people with drug addiction are not restricted simply to Christianity or Judaism, but could come from any background. So they made it kind of non-sectarian in that way. However, an important factor for this to be successful is the concept of the higher power. And this is something that many people, whether they're alcoholics or not, in modern society have a problem with, because just as in this verse and purport are talking about materialistic, atheistic philosophers of the past who may still have a following in certain circles, modern society has its own version of these ancient philosophies. The modern society may think that it's kind of coming up with new things, but actually these things are not new. They're as old as the Srimad Bhagavatam. The problem was in these groups that I was conducting that many of the people could not relate to this concept of a higher power. So my problem was, how do I give them some concept of a higher power without, because I'm working for an institution, a government institution, without mentioning Krishna, without reading from the Bhagavad Gita. Because actually that's the solution, is to read the Bhagavad Gita. The solution is in there. But how to give them that without giving them that directly was the problem. So by meditating on the meaning of Bhagavad Gita verses, because all the way through the Bhagavad Gita, here and there Krishna's saying, I am this, I am that, I am the source of this, I'm the source of that. In the Bhagavad Gita it's very clear that Krishna is the source of everything. But how do we get that across without saying Krishna? So to get the people's minds into that space, I started with them by discussing nothing. Because actually, this is the crucial thing. What do we mean by the word nothing? So some people will say, well, you know, an empty shelf, there's nothing on the shelf. Or outer space, you know, there's empty space, there's nothing in outer space. But these things are actually not really nothing. The empty shelf is simply a space into which you can put something. You can measure that space. So if you measure it, and this is according to the way that modern scientists think, if you can measure it, then it exists, right? Same with outer space. You know, it may have very little or no matter in it, but nevertheless, you can still measure its dimensions. Therefore, it's something. It's not nothing. So the more we pursue this idea of nothing, we come closer to the idea, well, non-existence, okay? Absolute non-existence would really be nothing. Right? If we try to conceive of absolute non-existence in our mind, we can't, because it doesn't exist. Right? It has no dimensions, it's nowhere, it has no characteristics. It doesn't, by definition, it doesn't exist. There's no such thing as non-existence. So then, if we accept that there's no such thing as non-existence, what does it tell us about existence? It's opposite. So, if we think about existence, the sum total of existence, and we ask questions like, how long has existence existed? For existence to have not always been, there would have had to have been non-existence at some point, which we have concluded that doesn't exist, there's no such thing as non-existence. Therefore, and you can do the same with the size, right? So, because the size of something, if the size of something is measurable, if it's finite, it has a boundary. So if there's no such thing as non-existence, then existence can have no boundary. And so in time and space, existence is unlimited. It's eternal, it has no beginning and end, and it has no... it's infinite, it goes on forever. It's unlimited. So where is existence? Well, if it's always existed, and it's everywhere, it's infinite, then it means it's everywhere. So those are kind of impersonal aspects of the absolute. We've got eternity, eternal. We've got infinite, infinity, it's infinite, and it's omnipresent. Right? And then where does everything that we are aware of come from? Well, it must come from this sum total of existence, because there's nowhere else for it to come from. Everything we know of, everything that we perceive as existing, has come from this sum total of existence. So it's the source of everything. So there we have four characteristics: eternal, infinite, omnipresent, and the source of everything. So these are, we'll come back to that in a second. And if we then if we consider the universe, modern theorists, modern scientists have their theories, which are very similar to these atheistic theories that Prabhupada is talking about in his purport today. They see matter as the source of everything. But then when we start to ask the question, where does the universe come from? Can't appear out of nothing, because logically there's no such thing as nothing. Right? For a start. And then if we ask the question, how big is it? Well, if we accept the idea of the Big Bang, which is not actually incompatible with what the Srimad Bhagavatam discusses in terms of, you know, the universes. In the Bhagavatam we have Mahavishnu lying in the causal ocean, in his mystic slumber, as he breathes in and out, the universes alternately emanate from the pores of his body and then return into his body. So those universes are described as bubbles in the cosmic ocean. So the universe, according to the Big Bang theory, is also a bubble, right? Because it's coming into being with this Big Bang and it's expanding, which means it's finite. It has an outer edge to it. It has to have an outer edge if it is expanding. And so, how old is it? Well, however old it is, it's not eternal. Right? If it's coming into being at a certain point, it means it's temporary. It's under the influence of time. And how does it originate? Well, that's the question. But so, going back to these characteristics of this sum total of existence, if you go around, any group of people, even if they're atheists, and you say, well, you know, people all over the world believe, you know, in different countries, believe in some way in God, right? And what are the common characteristics of this entity that people refer to as God? Right? So you come up with this list. That God is eternal, God's infinite or unlimited, God's omnipresent, God's the source of everything. So right there, those same four kind of impersonal attributes of the sum total of existence. But also God is omnipotent, that means God can do anything, and God is omniscient, God knows everything. So those two require consciousness, God being a person, right? So that's a little bit more difficult to present to an atheist. But the impersonal characteristics of the sum total of existence, hard for atheists to deny these kind of characteristics of the sum total of existence. So that gives them some kind of idea of an eternal, of a higher power. So if we take these one at a time. These all, of course, all come from Bhagavad Gita, or the Shastras, right? So, for eternal, for example, in Bhagavad Gita, second chapter, text 16, Krishna says, those who are seers of the truth have concluded that of the non-existent there is no endurance, and of the existent there is no cessation. This seers have concluded by studying the nature of both. And 2:12, never was there a time when I did not exist. I am being the sum total of existence, Krishna. Nor you, nor all these kings, nor in the future shall any of us cease to be. So God's eternal. Then infinite or unlimited. The verse is the invocation of Sri Ishapanishad. It's very nice in this connection. Actually, this book, I've had this particular copy of the Sri Ishapanishad since I was given it by my good wife Satrasara back in 1982, and she has a very effective and simple Sankirtan technique. It's read these, and on the top of the stack is this. So this here, as soon as I read it, from the page, I recognize this verse because it's very familiar, because I'd heard it so many times over and over by listening to the Radha Krishna Temple album made by the devotees from George Harrison. Om Purnamadaha Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishate. The personality of Godhead is perfect and complete, and because he is completely perfect, all emanations from him, such as this phenomenal world, are perfectly equipped as complete wholes. Whatever is produced of the complete whole is also complete in itself. Because he is the complete whole, even though so many complete units emanate from him, he remains the complete balance. So I've often wondered why Prabhupada chose Sri Ishapanishad out of all the Upanishads. There are many reasons, but this verse actually is very significant to me anyway, because if we take the complete whole as being equivalent to the sum total of existence, no matter how many universes or cosmoses are produced by this sum total of existence, by this complete whole. There's nowhere else for them to be other than within the sum total of existence. So simultaneously, they are separate entities, but they're also non-different. So this verse is actually an expression of Lord Chaitanya's philosophy of Achintya Bheda Bheda Tattva, simultaneous oneness and difference. Everything that is produced by this complete whole is simultaneously one with and different from this complete whole. Alright, so I was talking about being infinite or unlimited. So, the personality of Godhead, is unlimited in this way, is this unlimited complete whole. Then omnipresence or all-pervasiveness. Bhagavad Gita 9.4, Krishna says, by me, in my unmanifested form, this entire universe is pervaded. And in Bhagavad Gita 10.42, Krishna says, with a single fragment of myself, I pervade and support this entire universe. So it goes really, almost goes without saying, but not really, that the sum total of all existence is present within everything, everywhere within everything that is created. And also that Krishna is the source of everything. Bhagavad Gita 9.5, although I am the maintainer of all living entities and although I am everywhere, still myself is the very source of creation. 9.6, as the mighty wind blowing everywhere always rests in ethereal space, know that in the same manner all beings rest in me. 10.41, know that all beautiful, glorious and mighty creation spring from but a spark of my splendor. And Bhagavatam 2.9.33, prior to this cosmic creation, only I exist and nothing else, either gross, subtle, or primordial. After creation, only I exist in everything, and after annihilation, only I remain eternally. Nice verse there. So when you compare the characteristic, the commonly accepted characteristics of the entity people call God, with the sum total of existence, basically you get the same list of characteristics with those with omnipotence and omniscience implying conscious action and perception. So arguing that the sum total of existence is a conscious entity does get difficult when you're talking with an atheist, and maybe that's not something that we should even attempt. But our arguments can go along the lines that we are conscious, and so the source of us must also be conscious, and we are persons, so that source must also be a personality. So if we go back to the universe, so we establish the universe is temporary and it's finite, and so the relative size of the finite universe, if we assign the number one to the universe, one universe, right? And it's limited. So anything that's limited within an unlimited sum total of existence can be expressed as one over infinity of the sum total of existence, right? Which is in fact the smallest fraction you can get, right? One out of an infinite number. So the universe is just a minute speck, just like that. The universes are described as so many mustard seeds in a barrel. They're just like tiny, in this huge, infinite cosmos. And material manifestations are only part of the sum total of existence. Right? So you know, the universe being finite, and we can say, okay, yeah, there's an infinite number of universes. The material energy constitutes, Prabhupada explains, that the material energy constitutes one quarter of the sum total of existence. However, that means it's still infinite, right? A quarter of infinity is still infinity, right? Which means that there's room in the material energy for an infinite number of universes. So this, you know, the scientists have this idea of whether there's a multiverse, you know, alternate universes. So yeah, they're getting on the right track there. And it wouldn't be the first time that they found things in what they describe, of course, as Hindu scriptures, that in some way resonate with their modern theories of how the universe came about and what it is. So there are two natures, basically. There's, you know, if you've got the sum total of existence and only four, and it's spiritual, and the material energy is only a quarter of it. You've got the material and you've got the spiritual. Although the spiritual is also pervades the material. So there are two natures: spiritual, which is eternal, infinite, and non-material, and then there's material, which is temporary, because it's under the influence of time, and it contains finite manifestations. So then, Bhagavad Gita 8:20 nicely sums that up. Yet there is another nature, which is eternal and is transcendental to this manifested and unmanifested matter. So nice. Another nature which is eternal and it's transcendental to this manifested and unmanifested matter. It is supreme and is never annihilated. When all in this world is annihilated, that part remains as it is. So, just like in the 12-step program, the participant is sort of led to a service position with respect to the higher power. So, why Krishna consciousness is so supremely effective in this way is because it gives the full details of how to practice. You know, what is it that you need to do to be Krishna conscious? Bhagavad Gita 10:8. Krishna says, "I am the source of all material and spiritual worlds. Everything emanates from me. The wise who know this engage in my devotional service and worship me with all their hearts." And then Krishna ends up by reminding us how to do this. "Always think of me and become my devotee. Worship me and offer homage unto me. Thus you will come to me without fail. I promise you this because you're my very dear friend. Abandon all varieties of religion and just surrender unto me. I shall deliver you from all sinful reaction. Do not fear." So we may not be, hopefully, alcoholics or drug addicts, but we are in our own way material addicts. And we have this addiction that we need to get free of. And this is the process. This is what Krishna is wanting to deliver us from, is this addiction to material life, material activity. In the purport to today's verse, Prabhupada mentions, or the verse itself mentions, but also Prabhupada mentions different ancient rishis, and particularly Jaimini is mentioned. So Jaimini in the Chaitanya Charitamrita in various places, these different ancient rishis are mentioned and their philosophy. So Jaimini is one of seven saints who are contemporaries of Vyasadeva, who were engaged in similar work while Vyasadeva was compiling the Vedanta Sutra. Karmis desiring material enjoyment, Prabhupada says, may consider philosophers like Jaimini to be Mahajanas. So these are saintly people, but they have a philosophy which is not in tune with Srimad Bhagavatam and Bhakti Yoga. Srila Prabhupada says, for the conditioned soul busy in sense gratification, a Mahajana is recognized according to the proportion of sense gratification he offers. So there are six philosophical theses with different sages who are their proponents. There's Vaisheshika, that's Kannada Rishi, Nyaya, which is Gautama Rishi, Yoga or Mysticism, which is Patanjali, Sankhya, the atheistic form of Sankhya, that is, that's Kapila Rishi, not Devahuti Putra, Kapila Dev of Srimad Bhagavatam, but a different Kapila. There's Kama Mimamsa, which is Jaimini Rishi's philosophy, and then there's Brahma Mimamsa, or Vedanta, which is propounded by Vedavyas, and which is the ultimate conclusion of the absolute truth given in Srimad Bhagavatam. So modern versions of these atheistic philosophers pervade our society. And in the 20th century, modernism, what they call modernism, which is a belief in objective reality and logical thinking. So this was very prominent up until towards the end of the 20th century. And it was replaced by what they call postmodernism. This philosophy kind of came into being, or came to the fore in the 1970s and 80s, and continued certainly to the beginning of the 21st century. So this postmodernism can be summed up by something that a professor at, when I was at university, said to the class that I was in, said, there's no such thing as absolute truth. So the modernists were trying to, the scientists were trying to come up with these theories and these formulas and these equations that say, this is how things are. Right? And ultimately, as Sariputta Prabhu would say, they wanted to come up with a formula you could wear on your t-shirt that described, you know, everything in existence. But over time, their attempts to do this kept being unsuccessful, because they were saying, okay, this is, we've just finally discovered, this is how it is. And then somebody else would come along with some more information, so they have to modify it, and they'd have to modify it, and they'd have to keep modifying these theories until in the end they didn't look very much like how they started off. So that was kind of what led into this postmodernism, which, where they think, well, there is no such thing as the absolute truth. You know, the truth is whatever the best we can come up with at the moment, and we know that somewhere down the road somebody else is going to come along with some more information, we're going to have to change it a bit, and then that will be the truth. So this is the modern version of scientific truth, so-called truth. But in a strange way, this postmodern philosophy may actually be quite accurate, because scientists, their business only deals with the material. If they can't observe it and they can't measure it, as far as they're concerned, it doesn't exist. So, just like these other ancient philosophers that were mentioned in the verse, they're deniers of duality. They don't accept that there is a spiritual reality at all. They only see the material reality. And The modern thing is that, okay, there's no such thing as the absolute truth. And a way of illustrating this is actually, if you want to pinpoint the exact location of something, right? Let's say I wanted to know, okay, where is Hansarupa Prabhu? So somebody would say, well, he's in New York. So if we had a globe of the Earth, and you can see New York is on there, you say, okay, Hansarupa Prabhu is there in New York, right? However, that's not very precise, because New York's a big city, and so many, you know, so then we say, well, where exactly in New York is Hansarupa Prabhu? So then, you know, we'll get a street map and we'll think, well, he's there, which he might be, you know, he might be, you know, out somewhere else. But we can do that, but if we try to pinpoint, okay, if we keep going, and we want to try to pinpoint the exact location of, say, some atom, we can never actually because we can go smaller and smaller and smaller, and there's no limit to how small we can go in describing the position of something. Right? So we can never be fully precise. It's like measuring the size of something. You can't actually, you can say, well, this piece of paper is like 11.5 inches long. But actually, if we try to measure it precisely, we cannot, because our measurement, not only our measuring instruments, but the actual location in space of the edge of this is not, it can never be actually precisely defined. So that in that way, that's the material energy, the material manifestation is like that. It appears like it's kind of really fixed, but actually when you get down to it, it's not. Like even this cabinet here, or the danga, or the asasan, or anything in this temple room, it looks like it's solid, but really it's almost all empty space. It's just the way that the energy is vibrating and the way that our senses and our brain interprets it that we see it that way. So anyway, the postmodernist philosophy is helpful in one way to us, whereas previously the modernists would there's no such thing as spiritual, and they would dismiss other philosophies. At least they were. Now we have the opportunity to be recognized because we have a worldview that is, you know, a definite worldview, a distinct worldview that has to be recognized now by in a postmodern world. So going back to right. So Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada, and I was thinking, how has Krishna consciousness changed? How is it changing the world? Maybe even Krishna consciousness had some influence in moving from modernism to postmodernism. But anyway, I can remember London pre-Krishna consciousness, because that's where I grew up. And there was a famous singer in the UK in the 1960s. His name was Donovan. He was kind of like a British version of Bob Dylan, kind of. Anyway, he had this one song that he wrote about Googe Street, which is near to Tottenham Court Road, which is near to Soho Street, the temple, that area of London. So this is before the devotees came. In his song, he's talking about this, there were a lot of spiritual seekers back then, but their method of spiritual seeking was usually involved some kind of drugs. And in the song, he says, "Smash it." He's a beatnik as well as a hippie. He's a beatnik, so he's very into poetry and that kind of thing. "Smashing into neon streets in their stoneness, smearing their eyes on the crazy Kali goddess." Because at that time, there was this cafe in Tottenham Court Road that had this big deity of the goddess Durga. These were arms and weapons and everything. I remember seeing it when I was a kid. And I was thinking, then Prabhupada's disciples came, Yamuna and Shamasundar and Govinda Maharaj and Malati, and I'm forgetting some of them, but anyway, they're all there. And then they introduced the Hare Krishna mantra, and in 1969, and everything changed. And now, if you go to that area, of course, instead of seeing the goddess Kali in a cafe, you can see, if you go into the temple, of course, you'll see Sri Sri Radhakrishnan and Lord Jagannath in the Soho Street temple. And every day, there are devotees going on the street, chanting holy names and doing Harinam. And every year, there's a massive Ratha Yatra festival, with thousands and thousands of people attending, and it stretches for at least half a mile as it's going along beside the Hyde Park. And And it's just massive. And then there's Bhaktivedanta Manor, and today, because of the deities there, of course, there's Sri Sri Sitaram, Lakshman Hanuman, as well as Radha Gokula Nanda. There's going to be massive numbers of people turning up to celebrate Diwali. So all this was not there before Prabhupada came. And he sent his devotees ahead of him to bring Krishna consciousness and prepare for his arrival. And so Krishna consciousness over the years has filtered so much into society, not just in London but all over the world. And it's bringing that formula for getting free of this material addiction, which is the chanting of the holy name and the practice of bhakti yoga. Hare Krishna. Does anybody have anything to add on this verse? Because there's actually a lot of things that could be said about this.
You know how we say...
Thank you, Guru. You know how we say this creation, Krishna's complete creation, is unlimited. Spiritual world is unlimited. Living entities are unlimited. And then how can we divide that into three quarters is spiritual world and one quarter is material world? How can a quarter of unlimited, how can you say, you know, unlimited can be a quarter?
If you do it mathematically, one quarter times infinity is infinity over four, which is still infinity.
It'll still be zero.
No, it'll still be infinity.
Infinity.
Yeah.
Huh?
Yeah, it's just... It's Krishna's mystic opulence. Behold my mystic opulence. What's that verse? It's 11... I can't remember that verse, but it's...
Yeah.
It's Krishna's mystic opulence. Right? It's if you're talking about infinity, that's all like already inconceivable. So a quarter of infinity being also inconceivable is not surprising.
To calculate, right? That makes sense.
It is. It's a quarter times infinity over one. So one times infinity equals infinity. Four times one equals four. So it's infinity quarters, which is still infinity.
Maybe you can also think another way that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and Sanatana Goswami had conversation. Because we come from the material concept of life, Maya, that which is measurable. So we are growing in this creation that something measurable, something figurative. So then when Sanatana Goswami Pad says, where is spiritual world, how big? Then Mahaprabhu says, well, you can multiply 10 times 8. He said 80, okay, times 100, 800, times 1,000, so then 800,000, times 100. So then he went on and on, and at one point Sanatana Goswami Pad says, I can't go anymore, but Mahaprabhu says, that is what spiritual is. It makes sense because we like to figure it out. It's a naturally in the, because we are attached to the matter. Matter means measurable. So we'd like to figure it out. But we have to come to a point where when we say infinite, we really, I mean, I don't understand what infinite means. But so Mahaprabhu gave that breakdown to Sanatana Goswami. I said, when your brain is incapable, okay, that is infinite.
Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Srimad Prabhupada ki jai.